Hi, this is Perry, and you're listening to the Chemist Corner podcast for Wednesday, December 1st, 2010. Welcome to Chemist Corner. I'm your host, Perry Romanowski, a cosmetic chemist and avid joggler. In fact, when I'm not writing about cosmetic chemistry, I'm usually joggling. Chemist Corner is a podcast about cosmetic science and is broadcast to help educate, entertain, and inspire current and future cosmetic scientists. The information and opinions discussed on Chemist Corner are those of the hosts and the guests alone. They do not necessarily reflect those of any past, present, or future employers. I know it's been a little while since our last episode, but we're back with another interview, some cosmetic science news, and a formulation technique. On today's show, we're going to have an interview with Dean Godfrey, an outspoken cosmetic chemist and crusader against chemical fear-mongering from the UK. It promises to be a fun interview. But before we get to the interview, let's cover a couple of cosmetic science news items that could affect your formulating efforts. According to a report by Cosmetics Design, the Cosmetic Ingredient Review Panel, CIR, will be taking another look at formaldehyde as used in cosmetics. This was prompted by complaints about a product called the Brazilian Hair Straightening System. The CIR is an industry-sponsored independent expert panel that is responsible for reviewing and assessing cosmetic ingredients and determining whether they are safe. It will specifically be looking at the ingredient as used in these hair smoothing systems. The CIR is actually a part of the PCPC, the Personal Care Products Council in the United States, and they're supposed to be an independent group made up of scientists, dermatologists, and academics. So presumably the information that comes out from them is solid and based on science. Last month, both Health Canada and the U.S. Occupations Safety and Health Administration, or OSHA as we call it, came out with reports that there was significantly more than 0.2% formaldehyde in these products. According to the CIR, 0.2% is the maximum allowable limit of formaldehyde when used as a preservative. The company who makes the product claims that they are using methylene glycol and not formaldehyde. They also say that the tests used by Health Canada and OSHA do not distinguish between the different chemicals. This is an interesting issue. When I first started in the cosmetic industry, I worked on a hair conditioner that contained formaldehyde as an ingredient. But according to experts, it really wasn't formaldehyde. See, formaldehyde is a gas, and when you put that ingredient in water, it chemically reacts to form a material known as methylene glycol. Now, in water, methylene glycol, there's an equilibrium between methylene glycol and formaldehyde. In this equilibrium, methylene glycol is about 99.6% of the species, and formaldehyde is about 0.4% of the species. The same is true of formaldehyde donor preservatives like DMDM hydantoin and imidazolidinyl urea. As some would say, methylene glycol was not tested for safety, so the limits on formaldehyde shouldn't apply. It sounds reasonable, but I'm not sure I would agree that the limits shouldn't apply. When the CRI testing of formaldehyde was originally done, it was probably not done on gaseous formaldehyde, but it was done on a liquid product. And if that liquid product was formalin, or a solution of methylene glycol, any results that they would have got should be applicable to a solution of methylene glycol. So I would think that it would still apply. Of course, I'm not an expert in this area, but it does make sense that there is more testing that should be done. It'll be interesting to see where the CIR comes out on this one. They're having a meeting in a couple of weeks in December, so maybe there will be some news soon. In the meantime, the issue of formaldehyde in the Brazilian hair straightening product will also be interesting to watch. There is a court case currently going on. I know the makers of the product say they don't use formaldehyde, but I'm not sure this is exactly accurate. Sure, they might not put formaldehyde directly in their products, but the chemical reaction that happens between the protein and the solution to get the hair straightening, it does involve formaldehyde creation and a reaction. That's what makes it work. Anyway, stay tuned for more information on this one. It will be interesting. This is an interesting technology and one that certainly does have an effect on hair. We'll see if people are willing to risk the exposure or the potential exposure to a compound that may have some problems. The other story I wanted to talk about was this report from the annual meeting of the American Academy of Dermatology about nanoparticles. Dermatologist Adnan Nasir gave a review of nanotechnology and how nanoparticles may eventually be used in cosmetic products. They are already used in sunscreens as titanium dioxide nanoparticles and zinc oxide nanoparticles, but the promise of the technology has industry looking to use them even more. Currently, the industry has accepted a voluntary ban on nanoparticles, particularly outside of the sunscreen area, and while they wait for the FDA to come back on deciding whether there's enough information to say that the products are safe or not. There were some interesting things that Dr. Nasir noted. First, the cosmetic industry leads all other industries in the number of patents filed for nanoparticles. So while companies aren't selling products with nanoparticles, they certainly are patenting things that can be used. Another thing is nanoparticles would help make ingredients that are aesthetically displeasing more acceptable. There are a number of, say, active ingredients that are really greasy, but you could use nanoparticles if you can get them down to that size that affects the feel, and you know, maybe that could reduce their greasiness and make them more effective in products. Nanoparticles can also be used to deliver active ingredients to the lower levels of skin, and so anti-aging creams that really deliver products to the dermis may be in order. Now, I would worry about them because as cosmetics, we're not supposed to affect the skin metabolism and skin biology like that, so I would be worried if we're getting into drug areas. But people who develop cosmeceuticals don't seem to be worried about that as much, and maybe it won't be a problem. And finally, nanoparticles are thought that they might be able to treat skin cancer. There's a nanoparticle of gold has been shown to actually treat melanomas in animal studies. And this technology might be applicable to humans. So that could be, there's a lot of good stuff coming out of nanoparticles and a lot of possibilities. Of course, people are afraid of new things, and nanotechnology is one too. People are afraid of nanotechnology, or at least some people are, and possibly for good reason. It is a bit concerning that the chemicals can start penetrating the skin and maybe get into the body. It's prudent that the FDA is continuing to investigate and test the technology for safety. Because the thing is, cosmetics are really safe, and we don't want to start adding technologies that make them less safe. I think nanotechnology will be the future of formulating, however. And I look forward to the new products that we can make when we get to use nanotechnology. Not just in cosmetics, actually nanotechnology in lots of different areas, like paints and coatings and inks. There's some really cool stuff that can happen. Really, I think we have peaked in things such as surfactant technology and emollients and things. And formulators really need some new ingredients and new forms of ingredients to make really serious improvements in cosmetics. And I think nanotechnology might just be the way. There are many different routes you can take to learn to become an expert formulation chemist, but few are more powerful than conducting your own knockout experiments. These type of experiments can help you learn a number of things, such as function of raw materials, the performance effect of a raw material, and the formula effect of a raw material. It can also potentially lead to discovery of new formulations and cost savings ideas. The term knockout experiment was taken from the field of genetic engineering. In it, scientists create organisms in which they have to remove or knock out a specific gene. Then they see what the effects of the removal of a certain gene has on the organism. In the cosmetic chemist's version of a knockout experiment, you take a known formula and knock out a specific raw material. You then see what effect the absence of that raw material has on the final product. It's a simple yet powerful study that can quickly get you familiar with any formula. Now, when you first start your cosmetic formulating job, you will often start new projects with a formula that your company had previously developed. I remember the first formula I ever made, which was a shampoo, was originally developed by the guy whose notebook I inherited. My boss asked me to make samples to give to our marketing group for evaluation. I really had no clue about why any of the raw materials were used, what they did, or even how they worked together. You will undoubtedly be in the same position if you're just starting in this industry. Even if you have been around for a long time, it's impossible to know the effect of raw materials in any formula you haven't personally made or observed being made. Knockout experiments can rapidly tell you when making a batch exactly which ingredients have the most effect, which ones can be removed, and which ones interact with each other. When you're done making the formulas, you can learn what raw materials have the most impact on the final specification and product performance. Now, the amount of information you can learn from a single knockout study makes it well worth doing on really any formula that you are asked to work on or that you're developing. Now, there are different ways that you can run a knockout experiment, but it's pretty much basically this simple. All you do is take your initial formula, make a series of batches in which you remove one ingredient, and then you test the ingredients afterwards. Now, if it's a water-based formula, you simply add water to replace the missing mass. So if you had a formula in which you had an ingredient like cocamidopropylbutane in at 5%, you would just make the formula, but instead of putting the betaine in at 5%, you would leave it out and you would fill it with water at 5%. You'd fill back that extra missing mass. And you pretty much go through that and you make a series of formulas and then test them. Now, while it's best to make a new formula for each ingredient, this might be impractical, and some ingredients really can be ignored. And some of them that you don't have to make special batches for would include dye, the extracts, say the preservatives, and fragrance maybe even. If you don't know which ingredients are superfluous, you could ask one of your more experienced peers, but be careful. It is wrong to make any assumption about a formula. There could be ingredients you expect to have no effect that really do have an effect. I once tried to add cyanocobalamin, which is a vitamin, to a formula, and without really adding it, I just put it in a really small amount. And then when I finally got around to making a batch, I noticed that the ingredient turned the whole product pink. It was really quite a mess. So you can't really assume that ingredients are going to have no effect. Now, after you've made all the batches, you will end up with a series of formulas that need to be tested. You should do pH and viscosity measurements, of course, and then you can do any other performance characteristics that you might want to do. Say, if it's a foaming product, you can do a foam testing. For lotions, you can do a moisturizing test. Really, perhaps the most important thing to do is try the product yourself. Try to experience what a consumer will see and write down what is happening to the product. Also, write down any significant changes, because these will be helpful when it comes to creating your formulas and bringing it out to the production level or the production area. The knockout experiment is not a perfect way to learn all you can about a formula. There are important synergistic effects that you will definitely miss out on. That's why, DOE, which is design of experiment, is really often superior. However, you really can't beat the knockout experiment for speed and ease. And you'll definitely learn a lot about raw materials really quickly. To become a great formulation chemist, you have to make a lot of batches and try many different ingredients. The knockout experiment helps you get there a lot faster. All right, in our interview today, we're interviewing Dean Godfrey. Dean Godfrey has worked in the cosmetic industry and specifically focused on preservatives since about 1981. He's had jobs with various companies around the UK, including the Boots Company and Nipa Laboratories. He obtained a BS in chemistry from Open University in 1996 and has been an active member of the UK Society of Cosmetic Scientists, where he has held various positions on the SCS Council, including president from 2009-2010. Welcome to the program, Dean.
Hi, it's good to see you.
How are you? So you're out there in the UK.
Yes.
How close is that? How close are you to London?
Oh, almost 200 miles away.
Oh, well.
It's a different country.
It is?
I'm actually in Wales.
Oh, okay, Wales. Well, there you are.
I'm not Welsh, but the Welsh consider the English to be different.
You see, in America, the UK is London.
Yeah, I know that. I know that's why I said all that, to make some listeners appreciate that it's not London.
Yes, and
there's a lot to the UK than London.
Actually, when I worked at Alberto Culver, we had a place in Basingstoke, so I do know that.
Yeah, I'm still there. Yeah.
So we had you on the program because I've enjoyed some of your writings through the various social networks, LinkedIn, the Personal Care Truth website, and, well, you are a frequent commenter on many beauty blogs. But so I wanted to talk to you about some of that work, but first, how did you get into the cosmetic industry?
By accident, really. I was working at a company that produced Bronepol. They were the first manufacturers of Bronepol. And I got involved in a group working to look at different application areas for Bronepol, one of which was personal care.
For our listeners who wouldn't know, what is Bronepol?
Okay, Bronepol is a slightly out of favor preservative. It's a very good antibacterial agent. People don't tend to use it so much these days. But that was how I got involved in part in the cosmetics industry, and I enjoyed the cosmetics industry, and I sort of pushed myself towards working more and more in the cosmetics industry, with the result that now that's all I do, preservatives in cosmetics.
When you went to university, did you study chemistry?
Yes, I didn't actually go to university in the traditional sense. I did a distance learning. It's called the Open University in the UK. So I only relatively recently got a degree, but yes, in chemistry.
Okay. And so how did you end up working for the company that made Bronepol?
Straight from school. It was a large employer in the area, and I was working in a chemistry lab, and it sort of went from there. But it took some years of working in a chemistry lab before I got involved in cosmetics.
Were you involved in like chemical synthesis or QA?
Yeah, chemical synthesis, process development more specifically. So working on drugs like ibuprofen, for example. The company was the Boots company. They were the original manufacturers and inventors of ibuprofen.
Oh, really? Boots has they have the big chain of stores out there in the UK, right?
Yes, they do. Yeah. But they in those days, they had research labs and chemical production facilities as well. But that's all gone now.
Mm-hmm. What do you do on your job day to day?
I am responsible. I work for an ingredients distributor in the UK. We are not a manufacturer. And we represent various companies, some major, some smaller. My personal responsibility is for preservatives, and we source most of our preservatives from one manufacturer. But no manufacturer does all the preservatives that people use, so we get some from other sources. Mm-hmm. My role is to sell the preservative range, to provide technical backup to customers who need help, when requiring advice on preservatives, and also to develop new blends, new products, and seek out new possibilities. So I'm quite busy, and it's never more than now when people are moving away from certain preservatives.
One of the things that's always interested me is how a lot of the comments you had to say on, say, LinkedIn about preservatives and their view in the cosmetic industry. So what do you think of these, what do you think of preservatives as used in cosmetics? Are they safe?
Safe as used, yes. But you always have to qualify, whenever you claim anything is safe, you have to qualify that statement by saying within certain parameters, because I know you know perfectly well, everything is safe at certain levels and nothing is safe at other certain levels. And preservatives you have to be a little bit careful with. They're biologically active, they are designed to kill bacteria and fungi, and they are carefully regulated in the EU for that reason. Well, no one in the cosmetics industry wants to use preservatives. They don't add anything to the product. All they do is stop it spoiling, which is important, but if cosmetic formulators could get away without using preservatives, they would happily do so.
Well, do you think that creating formulas without preservatives is really a possibility?
Not without any preservation system. There is a difference between what is typically recognized as a preservative, especially in the EU where we have a positive list. But there are some ingredients which are recognized preservatives, and there are other ingredients which are recognized as having some other function, and the preservation may be a secondary function. It's more complicated in the EU because of our regulations.
For people who don't know about the positive list, what exactly does that mean?
Okay, in the European Union, we have a specific regulation called the Cosmetics Directive, and certain ingredients are specifically regulated using a positive list, UV absorbers and colours and preservatives. So in the EU, a preservative can only be used as a preservative if it is on that positive list. For example, I'll use the most popular example, methyl paraben, or the parabens in general. They're on Annex 6 of the Cosmetics Directive, which is the positive list for preservatives. Another widely used substance or ingredient that has some activity is caprylar glycol, as an example. That's not on the positive list, but because it has a primary function, arguably as an emollient, then people use it and claim that, oh, it happens to be, it's an emollient, but it happens to have a little bit of antimicrobial activity as well. But some people say that in the EU, again, that means that they can claim preservative-free, which is dubious,
right,
from a moral point of view and a scientific point of view. Pretty much every cosmetic product needs some form of preservation and protection, even some anhydrous products.
Anhydrous products, why would an anhydrous product need preservatives?
Well, you would expect, and a lot of people do work on the basis that if there's no water present, and we all know that water is essential for microbial growth, bacterial or fungal. But, okay, you may formulate the product without any water, but what happens is there's water in the atmosphere unless the product is packed in a dry atmosphere. Mm-hmm. And when conditions change, that water can condense. If there are any bacterial or fungal spores or just cells in stasis, not actually growing but not dead, then they can use that water to proliferate. There's a wonderful example of an ointment being used on a child who was in hospital, and the child had a staphylococcus infection which was threatening the child's life. And his mother was rubbing this ointment onto the child's skin where it was affected, to try and soothe the infection. But in fact, it was the ointment that contained the infection. And as soon as they stopped his mother from applying the ointment, the child recovered.
Ah.
And that was an anhydrous ointment, but it had got a staphylococcus infection. So it is still possible.
One of the things that always impressed me is when you're making comments about discussions that I've read, you seem to have read a lot of the studies. And when I was practicing cosmetic chemist on the bench, I would hear a lot of things out in the media about chemicals or hear things from, you know, the raw material suppliers. I just assumed everything was safe on some level. I figured the companies couldn't sell it to me if it wasn't. But the truth is, I didn't really know, see the first hand information about these things. So where would you suggest cosmetic chemists go, or where do you go to find out information about the studies that have been done on raw materials and whether they're safe?
Well, that's a really difficult question. For a cosmetic chemist, I think the starting point has to be the raw material supplier. The problem is, it's so difficult. Even scientific studies can be wrong. Most, I'm sure, are fine, but some are badly carried out and some are misleading. And the results aren't always presented in a way that is applicable to cosmetic science, shall we say.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a bit of a minefield, really. My personal first port of call would be the raw material supplier. In terms of what I do, I never used to read any safety information until the paraben scare started. And that really forced me to look at what the detail behind the headlines.
Mm-hmm.
That was quite scary, actually, because it's amazing how things can be blown up out of all proportion. And I promise I won't launch into my two-hour spiel on parabens and how they're not really that bad after all. it comes down to personal judgment quite often as to what information you use, because there's so much conflict in information out there. It's very difficult even for scientists.
Yeah, I do you use like the Cosmetic Ingredient Review Board, get information from them? Do they have an equivalent thing in the EU?
They do. In fact, if I may say, ours is better.
Well, we're always looking for better.
The charges that are usually leveled at the CIR is that it's industry funded. Mm-hmm. And I know the composition of the CIR panel has changed recently, and there are more independent people on it. But the people who would have us avoid most of the currently used cosmetic ingredients usually use that argument that the CIR is biased. In the EU, we have a separate commission, a panel appointed by the European Commission of independent scientific experts who are not related to cosmetics or to the industry. They're mostly academics. Mm-hmm. And they go beyond cosmetics anyway. It's the Scientific Committee for Consumer Safety. They do extensive reports in the same way that the CIR do. My first point of call would be the SCCS opinion. If that wasn't available for any one ingredient, I would check the CIR, because it's always better to look at reviews rather than individual studies. If you look at the individual study, you have to make your own judgment as to what you believe that study contains and the veracity of it. If you read a review by hopefully experienced and knowledgeable scientists, then they translate the science to a certain extent and they make it digestible. So it's always better than any individual study.
Yes, it's always amazing to me how people will come to different conclusions than experts in the field, especially when they don't know anything about the topic. What ingredients do you think cosmetic chemists should be aware of that consumer activist groups really deride, I guess?
The blunt answer to that is I would take no notice whatsoever of these consumer interest groups, because they generally don't know what they're talking about, and they often misinterpret information that they receive. And I am not aware of any scare or any specific scare that they've generated that really has any basis in fact, in terms of any ingredients truly being a danger to the consumer when used in cosmetics.
While this is true, it certainly does affect the way that the marketing people for cosmetic chemists have to put together formulas. So how would you suggest that a cosmetic chemist, I don't know, counter the kind of information that a consumer activist group, the kind of fear-mongering that the consumer activist groups do for both the consumers and for their marketing group that they're essentially formulating for?
Yeah, that's a very difficult thing to do. You and I tend to be quite vociferous when we see misinformation spread. What we need is every cosmetic chemist in the industry joining us and getting involved in these web discussions and on people's blogs when they see the ridiculous statements and claims that are made. But that's not going to happen, and it's down to a few people really who are prepared to stick their neck out and fight these guys. In terms of talking to the marketing people, I mean, I have it drives me to despair sometimes, because I will use the example of parabens because it's the one I know best. I'm often contacted by customers saying, "Can you recommend a preservative system? We don't want parabens." So I always, even after all these years, still say, "Why don't you want parabens?" And they say, "Because the consumers don't want it, because of consumer pressure." In fact, I believe very few consumers are aware of parabens at all. The people who are aware of parabens are those who regularly visit the Skin Deep website and get EWG communications and read certain blogs. Mm-hmm. There is an interesting website that I came across a couple of months ago called Care2, and it's a sort of general well-being, healthy living website, and they claim several million, I think it's 14 million consumer members. And they recently, well, it's still ongoing, but they started a poll a couple of months ago. Do you avoid parabens in products? And one of the answers, one of the available answers was, what are parabens?
Mm-hmm.
And 56% of all the respondents didn't know what parabens were. And at the moment, we're at over almost 2,500 replies to that survey. And in only 20% of those people said, yes, we avoid all products containing parabens. And that's from a section of society that I would expect would be aware of parabens. They're the healthy living, they're the green people
right
type. So I would extrapolate that and say the normal or the everyday consumer hasn't a clue about parabens. Even those who've read the scary stories in the newspaper, in 2 weeks' time, they forget.
Right.
So the consumer pressure is grossly exaggerated and driven by the handful of lobbying groups, such as the Environmental Working Group. So if I was a marketer, I would say, I'm going to dig my heels in, but it's easy for me to say that because I'm not a marketeer. But there is one major, at least one major UK brand who are doggedly sticking with parabens as preservatives, and they are not seeing a drop in sales. People don't care.
Yeah, unfortunately, marketing groups tend to. but that's good that information is good for cosmetic chemists to really push back and say, yeah, why? Why not have them in there?
If there is good science, I would not defend parabens if I truly believe that the science was robust, but it's not.
As far as preservatives go, do you think the world needs new preservatives, or are we fine with the ones that we have?
I think it depends on the nature of the new preservatives. There is always room for an increase in safety, but there is a misperception about preservatives. I'm often asked for mild preservatives.
Yes.
The problem with mild preservative is it's not as effective as a powerful preservative. So you use more. So the effects actually more or less balance out. And it's just a myth that you have mild preservation in most instances anyway. So, but I'm all in favor of new preservatives coming along if they're effective and safe. Variety is great. The problem with relying on a very, well, certainly if you only rely on one or two preservatives in your production plant, you stand a risk of developing resistance or tolerance. So you find yourself, this happens, you make the same product day in, day out on one plant, and then you start getting failures because there are house organisms that have developed a tolerance, and so you need to increase the preservative system.
If a cosmetic chemist wanted to make a natural cosmetic, what would you suggest they use for the preservative?
A natural magic wand. There are two problems here. One is the definition of natural.
Yeah.
And, that's the main problem, really. Everyone seems to have their own personal definition of natural. I am not aware of any truly natural preservative that is effective and acceptable in terms of odor, broad spectrum activity. The reason any natural preservatives or natural antibacterials exist is because they've evolved in the plant. The plant doesn't evolve a preservative for the sake of it. It evolves it as a defense mechanism against likely bacterial or fungal attack.
Mm-hmm.
So it will only develop, or it's only likely to develop, a specific preservative for its own needs, and nature wouldn't evolve something that isn't necessary. So most naturally occurring preservatives aren't broad spectrum. It should be possible to combine several natural preservatives and give it an overall broad spectrum effect, but a lot of them have strong odor or strong color, and some they're not all safe because as we know, natural doesn't mean safe.
Right. And you'd also have to know what are all the bacteria or all the microbes that you're trying to defend against, which seems difficult. I wanted to get on to talking a little bit about the Society of... But you guys are the Society of Cosmetic Scientists.
Yes, because we don't exclude anyone who isn't a chemist, you see.
I was just curious about that group out there. How did you get involved with the Society of Cosmetic Scientists, and what do you think of their role in the cosmetic industry out there?
I got involved with the SCS because I was told to when I started one of my jobs 18 years ago. And I was told to get involved with the SCS and be active. It was the best move I ever made career-wise because the networking possibilities are amazing if you throw yourself into it. And I joined the social committee of the SCS and generally hung around at events. And you get to know people. And it really is a great industry. I'm sure it is in the US, but I can only speak from the UK point of view. It's a very friendly industry.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of been one of the best parts of my career, actually, has been the involvement with the SCS. Culminating last year in the presidency, I'm proud to say.
Yes, congratulations.
So just to show you, hang around long enough, that'll make you president here.
Well, I've enjoyed the talk very much, Dean. Thanks so much, and thanks for talking with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, that's our program for this week. I thank you for listening. As always, you can follow us on Twitter as Chemist Corner. You can also follow us on Facebook. You can find the Cosmetic or the Chemist Corner page on Facebook. And of course, if you have any questions, contact us through the blog, and you can also connect with us on LinkedIn. I'm going to be in the New York area from in December 8th through 10th for the national meeting of the Society of Cosmetic Chemists. If you're in the area, feel free to send me a tweet or leave me a message via the blog, and maybe we can meet up. I always enjoy meeting with fellow cosmetic chemists and listeners of the podcast here. Well, that's all I have. I thank you for listening. Now, go make a difference.